living hell.
This is what real hope looks like. This is the word that those hopeless people need to hear. This is the word that 3,000 people that try to commit suicide today, the 3,000 that will try to commit tomorrow, 3,000 that will try to commit on Monday, this is the word that they need to hear, is that there is hope.
It's real superpower. It's hope. There's hope.
Welcome to Victims and Villains. This is the show where we talk nerd, we talk hope, and we speak nothing else. I am your host, Captain Nostalgia. Thank you for choosing this mission to listen to our review of Mission Impossible Fallout. And if you guys follow us on Facebook, this is take two. This is a little bit later than promised. Has some technical difficulties, but please help me in welcoming his mission, should he choose to accept it, Mr. Ryan Silverstein over at the Shame Files podcast.
Hey, hey, very happy to be here again. But it's a good thing because I could talk about Mission Impossible and Fallout in particular for hours at a time if needed. So happy to do a take two if it means getting it out to the people.
Yeah, same. And like it seems like once every like 4 months this happens where like we'll just crash. So hopefully this like new way of going with Google Hangouts just totally kills that.
it's a hazard of podcasting in general. We have a few I call them lost episodes. Like we have one or two where we weren't even able to like reschedule the guests in time, and it was just like, well, you know, it's a conversation that we had that we really enjoyed, but sadly no one else gets to hear it. So I'm glad I was able to, that we were able to connect, you know, at least this week and get back together.
We have one other lost episode, and the reason that it's considered a lost episode is because the file is actually too big for any streaming service that we did. So we had it on, we had it originally on the internet at one point, but it's just now too big, so it doesn't exist. It'll one day make its way out to the public again, but let's jump into what the Shame Files podcast is. So tell us a little bit about what the Shame Files podcast is.
Yeah, so my wife and I are both film critics. We run Cinadelphia.com, which has a bunch of other people that write about movies, and we all love movies, but one problem that she and I face is that we're much more likely to rewatch a Star Wars movie or a Marvel movie than we are to necessarily go back and fill in those gaps in our, you know, cinematic education, so to speak. And so we created the Shame Files podcast based on the concept that we occasionally write about is, hey, let's watch movies that are on our list of shame that we haven't seen before. So they're new to us, but they're considered classics, and then have an in-depth discussion about it. So the podcast is sort of a byproduct of us trying to fill in those gaps and watch more older films that we may have missed for one reason or another, and, you know, kind of discover them, and people can follow along and, you know, on our mission of discovery.
And I feel like there are certain films out there that when you talk to moviegoers or like cinephiles. Yeah, that one.
Yeah.
There is just this, like, you have to see this film. Like there are just certain, you know, masterpieces that are regarded that way. And I feel like there are so many Hitchcock films that are regarded that way. The Godfather trilogy, Back to the Future, Star Wars, like then the list goes on and on. Like there are just these must-see films. And so to kind of create a podcast where you're saying, look, I'm a cinephile, but I have so much shame that I haven't seen X, Y, or Z. What's it like kind of choosing each film that you guys are going to cover week to week?
Yeah, it's a hard process. So we have a master list where we went through like the whole like AFI top 100, and we went through like a list of movies that have won like Best Picture at the Oscars. And we've kind of pulled out ones that I haven't seen, one that she hasn't seen, and ones that we both haven't seen. And then we kind of throw that together with movies that we've like heard about or we've kind of always wanted to see. Like one of our favorite episodes that we did was on Donnie Darko, because for some reason we both just missed it. And that's like, you know, it's a classic, it's like a cult classic. And you're making the space of like, how did we not seen that? But that's exactly that's why we do the show, is because for some reason we both just missed Donnie Darko. And so we had a really great discussion about it. And we tend to have a monthly theme. So for July, we are doing, we did All Spies. We just put out our last episode in that series. So we kicked it off because my wife had not seen the original Mission Impossible. So we kicked it off with that. We did 39 Steps. We did Manchurian Candidate. And we wrapped up with The Spy Who Came In From a Cold. The cold, rather. And so having a monthly theme kind of gives us a way to organize, because otherwise it's almost like two blank slate. And then sometimes we'll do a month where it's just like, you know, movies that are tied into other things coming out, you know, where we'll go back, and if it's a remake, we'll go and see the original if we haven't, or, you know, something to tie it into what's going on right now. But, you know, a lot of times it's just like, we'll pick a theme. Like in March, we did all musicals and picked musicals that we hadn't seen, that had, you know, like a really good reputation.
And I think that's one thing that I've appreciated about discovering your podcast, is that you guys aren't just doing, yes, you guys are doing these themes, but it's not just these older films that, like you talked about, like you did Donnie Darko. There was one last year around the time that you guys did Disaster Artist. You guys also had covered The Room, which is an interesting experience if you've never seen it.
Yeah, we watched The Room, and we watched The Room. We went to a midnight showing of The Room and saw Disaster Artist all in the same like weekend. Like, it was crazy. So we like watched The Room first, and then I can't remember if we did the podcast before or after we saw the midnight showing, but we watched it at home because friends of mine who are really big fans of The Room were like, seeing it at a midnight screening, people are throwing stuff, they're reacting to it. Like, you're not really gonna, you'll appreciate it more if you watch it at home first, and then go to the the more interactive experience, which is really funny because that is the right advice. But then I was like, wait, so I have to watch the worst movie ever twice, you know, just to appreciate it more. But I actually find The Room like a really fun experience. There's a lot of other movies that I think are harder to watch because they're boring, even though they're probably technically better. But The Room is like a great imitation of what a movie is, without actually understanding how movies work.
Totally agree. I was actually just yesterday wearing my Tommy Wiseau shirt. It came out T.T. Fury did a shirt that was a Christmas sweater with him doing the "You're Tearing Me Apart, Lisa." And I was So have there been any films that you've kind of come across and just don't understand why they're regarded as classics?
I'm sure there has been. Let me look at my list, because I am like terrible at one I definitely want to call out is Meet Me in St. Louis, which we did for our like musical month. And like, it's really critically acclaimed, but nobody tells you how weird that movie is. Like, there's like a Halloween sequence that's almost like a horror movie in this middle of this like really brightly covered musical. I'm trying to look at our list. I feel like the one that didn't really live up to the hype for me that we did recently actually was Tropic Thunder, which I thought was like it's really funny, but like I feel like I had actually absorbed all of the really funny parts just by being alive in the culture without having seen the film in full. And that's one where my wife and I, like, we were talking on the podcast where we have no idea, like, not, we didn't know each other at the time, I don't think. But neither of us had any idea why we didn't see that movie, because it's both a movie that we would definitely, like, if it came out today, we'd be like, oh, we got to make plans, we got to go see it. It looks like it's really funny, and it is really funny, but it didn't quite live up to how funny the parts that I already knew of it were. But it was really interesting looking at it, because I think it came out like 10 years ago, so it was kind of interesting looking at it in all the sort of cultural progress that we've made in terms of, you know, awareness, you know, at least for me personally, around, you know, the way that people of different races are depicted in movies, and the way that the movie business has been depicted, and all the stuff that has come out of, you know, Me Too and these other movements recently. So it's actually really interesting watching it sort of 10 years removed, and like just being like, oh my God, like, it's amazing how much things have changed, where like Robert Downey Jr. won an Oscar, or was nominated for an Oscar for that role. But like the controversy around that, like I don't even know if this movie would come out today, because even though it's being a parody, there's a lot more awareness and sensitivity, which is, I think, overall a good thing. But it's just kind of interesting how it would play out, how it might play out for this particular case.
Fair enough, because I actually was not a huge fan of Tropic Thunder when it first came out. And people have told me about how hilarious it is and how it's just this great time, this great experience, and I need to go back and give it a second shot. But looking at it through that lens, it makes me have a little bit more respect for it.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like it's still going to be one of those films that I'm going to be like, I have my memories. That's good enough for me.
Supposedly the director's cut is really good, and I've committed to one of my friends that whenever he decides to dig it out of, you know, his parents' basement or whatever, wherever his DVD copy of the director's cut is, that I'm told that it adds like a half an hour to the movie, and there's really great stuff in there that actually like makes some of the character stuff work better. So we'll see.
Fair enough. The best thing about Tropic Thunder, in my opinion, was actually Tom Cruise.
Yes. He's amazing in it.
Who was kind of going through this like weird resurgence in his career where he kind of had like blockbuster fail after blockbuster. And that was kind of like his like resurgence back into the spotlight.
I feel like that is definitely the beginning of him coming back, like making his actual comeback and making it okay to be a fan of Tom Cruise again. Because like, you know, when like War of the Worlds came out, like he was during that press tour that he did his couch dance, you know, his infamous Oprah couch dance appearance. And that movie still made a lot of money because people were really talking about it. But then by the time Mission Impossible 3 came out, which was like a year or two later, like it basically like bombed because people had completely turned on him. But yeah, I definitely agree that I think Tropic Thunder is sort of like the beginning of him building himself back up in the mind of the public as an actor.
So with that, we are here talking about, again, Mission Impossible Fallout. So before we get into the actual discussion, we are going to rank our top five Mission Impossible movies before Fallout and after Fallout. So I'm going to let you go first, being our guest. What is your top five Mission Impossible films pre-Fallout?
Sure. So starting at the bottom, because there are only five at the moment, you know, pre-Fallout is the sixth movie. So they'll all show up on this list, but starting at the bottom is Mission Impossible 2, which, you know, rewatching it heading into Fallout was like the second, I think it was the third time that I had seen it. And I have more respect for it now in terms of like what John Woo is trying to do and how much fun it is to watch with like a group of people. But it's still not good. And it's the only one that's like, it's the only one that's not great. Like it's still more watchable than a lot of other like bad action movies. So it's still like a 3.5 star kind of experience, maybe. But like every other movie on this list is just like trying to rank them. It's like ranking like my favorite pets that I've had in my life because I have such fondness for all of these movies. So going up from that, I'm going to put Mission Impossible 3, which I think has some really great sequences in it. I really like Philip Seymour Hoffman's performance. But it doesn't quite have the level of spectacle that I come to appreciate in a Mission Impossible. It has a really cool Hitchcockian feel, you know, and I think it has all the ingredients that we see in all the other movies. I just think it's been bested by two of the movies that have come since, at least. So Rogue Nation is my number two, because I absolutely love that movie. It does a ton of stuff right, but it doesn't quite top Ghost Protocol for me, which is my number one Mission Impossible movie. And for me, it's because it captures best that team dynamic that I love. And, you know, everybody working together. And I really love the additional aspect of like the technology failing them. So like they have all these cool gadgets, but they're actually not working. And so it's like these incredibly smart, really talented people like working around the technology. And I think it just hits that like note of the teamwork and the humor and the spectacle with the, like, you know, Tom Cruise climbing the outside of the Burj Khalifa. Like, I think it has all of my favorite elements of a Mission Impossible movie at their height.
That's fair. And so my list kind of looks really similar. Number five is Mission Impossible 2. And like I said during the first time around when we were tried to record this is that this was my 2018 was my first exposure to this franchise, and I really enjoyed a lot of what I saw in this franchise. But the second film just was so subpar to the first film, and then you get the third film, and then the fourth film, and then it's not really all exciting, and I don't know. It's just
it's the Too Fast, Too Furious of the Mission Impossible franchise.
That's fair. Like, that sums it up perfectly. Number four for me is going to be Ghost Protocol, and like you said, like it's extremely tough kind of ranking these in there. Really had a great time with this movie. I thought that Jeremy Renner was a perfect addition to the team. I really loved the dynamic, and I really loved the concept behind this, but I loved the top three movies just a little bit more. So it's not necessarily that it's like one step above. It's just one step below my top three. Number three, the film that started it all, Mission Impossible. Love it. It's a classic fun film, and it adds a little bit of, has like a little bit of like a noir feel to it that I really appreciate. Number two, I'm going to go Mission Impossible 3 because Philip Seymour Hoffman, great villain, adding the character of Julie really brought depth to the Tom Cruise's Ethan Hunt in a way that we hadn't seen previous to that. So it was kind of like it became personal for him. And those are some of my favorite type of villains. That's why I argue so heavily that I don't know whether it's season two or season five of Arrow is better, because they're both villains that make it personal. And those are the best type of villains because they're like super unpredictable in how far they'll go. And Philip Seymour Hoffman was that to this franchise. I really enjoyed that. And then Rogue Nation is my favorite pre-Fallout film because I just really enjoyed it. It's just a fun film. It's got a solid villain, solid pacing, great action sequences, and great character dynamic that you just like you said, like you've kind of come to expect from a Mission Impossible film.
Hello, everybody. This is Jason.
And Aaron.
And we are the hosts of the For Better or Worse podcast. Like most couples, we have pretty different tastes.
There's a lot of things we agree on, of course, but it can be pretty difficult to find something to watch at the end of the day.
She likes comedies, love stories, and dramas.
And he likes anime, horror, sci-fi, and fantasy.
So we both thought it would be fun to force each other to watch our favorite movies, shows, or anything else we can think of, and record it here for you guys.
The show is a lot of fun, and it's not always torture. Sometimes we actually come around to each other's side.
We would love for you guys to give us a shot. So download For Better or Worse anywhere you listen to your favorite shows, and join us in the fun.
We can't wait to share our experiences with you.
Suit up.
See how he's been infiltrated. We're gonna have to go it alone.
You go rogue, he's been authorized to hunt you down and kill you.
No hard feelings.
What the hell is he doing?
You find it best not to look.
Mission Impossible Fallout, July 27th.
All right, so we're here talking about Fallout today, and right before we get ready to take a commercial break, want to know, what are your general thoughts on this film before we jump into spoilers?
Yeah, So I was able to see it twice, once in sort of regular kind of, you know, regular movie going movie theater experience, and once in IMAX. And if you're listening to this and you haven't seen Fallout yet and you have the opportunity to see an IMAX, it is definitely worth the extra ticket price, because Fallout is one of the best action movies of the last 10 years. It has everything that I want in a summer blockbuster in terms of, it's got huge spectacle, amazing action. The story is really compelling. I think it actually has maybe the best plot in a Mission Impossible movie in terms of what it means to the characters. And I think the way that it brings together, you know, it pays off a lot of the stuff from the first five movies, not in terms of like an ongoing story, but in terms of like how far the characters have come and what this particular mission ends up meaning to them. And so, you know, with those, the characters, the ideas that it plays with in a really interesting way, and all the action stuff, it's everything I could want in a summer movie.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that one thing that this film does extremely well is the balance of the characters and like the character development, and how when it comes to these action sequences that are big and brash, but they move the plot along. Like, they're not just there for spectacle or eye candy. Like, they actually have purpose. I really enjoyed the twists and the turns. And this is the first Mission Impossible film that brings back a villain. And so it really has that, and it kind of continues the storyline that Rogue Nation set up. So it really feels like this is a true trilogy, because with Ghost Protocol, you had the last scene where he's kind of walking away and he's like, oh, Mr. Hunt, your mission, should you choose to accept it, is, and then you got the Easter egg for the Syndicate, and the Syndicate blew up in five. And so here in six, you have what has happened because of the fallout of it. But I also really enjoy the aspect like of character dynamic and just the twists and turns. And like you said, I fully agree. I think that this is one of the best, if not the best, action movies that we've got in the last 10 years.
Yeah. And that, you know, one thing that you said about Mission Impossible 3 that Fallout also does is it makes Solomon Lane, who wasn't really a personal villain in Rogue Nation, makes him into a personal villain in Fallout, in terms of like he is really driven by wanting to bring down Ethan Hunt in particular. So there's other plans and things going on, but part of his plan is that, you know, he wants to really bring Ethan down to, like, just completely ruin his life by any means necessary. So that's the most I can say without spoiling anything. But, you know, I think that adds a layer to the film that we haven't, to the series that we haven't seen before, because it's bringing a villain back. And then it's adding in additional layers that the series hasn't gone to before.
Totally agree. And so with that, we're getting ready to jump into spoiler territory here. But if you guys haven't seen Mission Impossible Fallout just yet, listen to this real quick, because we're getting ready to take a commercial break. Before we go to commercial, just know that if you're listening to this right now, you or someone you know is struggling with suicide, addiction, self-harm, or depression, please reach out. Suicide is currently the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. There are 123 suicides that take place each and every day. And when you scale back internationally, there are 800,000 successful suicides. That's one death roughly every 40 seconds. You guys can reach out to us on any of our social media. Links will be in the descriptions with this episode for that. You guys can call the Suicide Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. Text anonymously to 741-741, or also go to victimsandvillains.net/hope for more resources. And with that, we'll be right back after this commercial break to talk spoilers of Mission Impossible Fallout. All right, welcome back. And so from this point on, this is spoilers country. We are talking spoilers, all things Mission Impossible Fallout. And when Ryan and I were conducting on what we wanted to really talk about in this episode, he had something that he was really passionate about, that he liked a lot about this film, and I did. I had something else. So we're going to talk about both of those things right now. And one of the best things that this film does really well is its action sequences. And so, like you talked about, like, there's a level of action and adventure that you have kind of come to expect as a Mission Impossible villain. So let's talk about the action of this film and kind of how they handle these sequences.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing is like that there's like two aspects for it. It's like, one, the action itself is incredible in the way that it's put together and the way that it's made. So it really makes you feel like you are there with the characters versus sort of observing from a distance, in a way. So, you know, there's a scene where Rebecca Ferguson's character, Ilsa Faust, is like yeah, and it's in the trailer, but she has she's driving a motorcycle through like a closed like market stall where there's like a bunch of columns and stuff on either side of her, and she's going really fast, and the air is just going like as she goes by each one. And it's just those little things, like those little sounds, because, you know, when you make a movie, like you choose what sounds to put in the movie, because if you recorded everything on set, you'd have people in the background, you have all kinds of weird noises and whatever. And so the way that movies are made, like they get to decide what sounds you hear and how loud they are. And I think, you know, it's a small thing, but it can make a huge difference. And I think in this movie, it really adds to the sense of realism that all the action scenes had. The other major piece of that is that Tom Cruise does a lot of his own stunts, and that if you can't tell it's Tom Cruise jumping out of an airplane or, you know, flying a helicopter, it's not going to be in a Mission Impossible movie, because like they want, yes, they do use stunt doubles. Like, yes, there's wires and things that like CGI removes, but a large part of it is, you know, it's creating that sense of realism by actually doing it. So like in the jump sequence, the helmet that that Tom Cruise and Henry Cavill wear was designed for the movie so that you could see their faces, because usually it's more like a motorcycle helmet where it has like a dark visor and you really can't see the person's face. But because, you know, they're big movie stars, you want to see that it's actually them doing it. And so that's why they had somebody with a GoPro type camera, like strapped to their helmet, jump out of a plane backwards in front of Tom Cruise. So you could see Tom Cruise jumping out of a plane, and having them lining up and filming the entire sequence at like a certain time of day. And it just, everything is done to maximize that sense of, you know, like you're actually there.
Yeah. And that's something that I really appreciate about these films, is because there's just this sense of realism and grounded nature to them. And you talk about most films that have these fight sequences have this tendency to orchestrate kind of music with it. Mm-hmm. But I think one thing that the Mission Impossible film franchise does extremely well that a lot of other franchises can't pull off or can't do is no sound, just mm-hmm. running it raw. And I think that that's one thing that I really enjoy about those action sequences, because not only do these action sequences feel like they're done in real time, but that element of removing the music makes you feel like you're actually there, and it puts you right in that action that I feel like few franchises can't even do. And there's the motorcycle chase through after they knock Solomon Lane into the river in the police car. That's probably one of the best examples of this. It feels like it's real time. It feels like this could really happen, and this is really what it would look like. And the removal of the music and just listening to the sounds around you, I think really brings that depth the few films can do.
Yeah, it almost gives it like a documentary feel in a way, where like you really do feel like you're there. Like both times I saw it, there's in that motorcycle chase sequence, Tom Cruise is driving the opposite way of traffic on a motorcycle through the streets of Paris, and there's a moment where a truck almost hits him, and I swear both times I saw it, I was like, "Oh my god, the camera is going to run into this truck." Like, because just the way that it's so close and it's so perfectly orchestrated that like they can have those what look like really close calls that I'm sure are done in like a very safe and controlled way, but it doesn't feel that way when you're watching it, because the way where the camera is placed, the way that you know, the whole scene is edited together, it really makes it feel real. And I think the bathroom fight scene is also like a really great example of that, because the only music in that is the music that the people are dancing to in the main part of the like concert hall or whatever. And so you have this really low like techno music that like you can barely hear. Like it's barely there. Like in IMAX, it's a little more noticeable because everything is just a little bit louder in IMAX. But, you know, you can kind of hear like the low, just like the low beat, but it's really, really way in the background. And what's louder is the breaking glass, the pipes, the water in the bathroom. And the way that the scene is put together, it's not like the quick cutting you know, like the Jason Bourne style action where like it's confusing and you can't really see what everybody's doing. And that can be really effective. But to me, nothing tops this, like, you can see all the actors in the frame. You can see what they're doing. You can see what they're trying to do. And just having really good choreography and really nice sort of like, you know, longer takes where you can really show off all the work that these people have put into making the movie. And I think, again, that all adds into that sense of realism.
Yeah, that bathroom scene is probably one of the best sequences in that. And because, like I said earlier, I think that one of the things that this film does extremely well is every action sequence that is existing, it is existing with the intention to move the plot forward. So that bathroom scene, while it does show off the it does move the plot forward in that this John Lark character, quote unquote, isn't really this Asian gentleman that we meet and have this awesome fight sequence with, but it is the reintroduction of the Elsa character. And what a better way to introduce this character in a way that you just don't expect it. And I feel like the twists and turns of this, the that really drive with the action is one thing that this thing does extremely well. And her arc in this is just so exquisitely handled, the way that it's, can you trust her? Can you not? And the more that her arc kind of unfolds, the more you kind of understand where she's coming from. But that bathroom scene alone, just bringing her in at that precise moment, beautifully done.
Yeah, and a lot of the action in the action scenes is driven by what would make sense for that character in that moment. So I love that introduction because, one, you're so focused on the fight between these three guys that you're not even thinking that somebody else like could show up and have an impact there. And then she walks in and like kills John Lark. And then we additionally find out that she was actually supposed to be protecting that guy. And so it tells us a lot about like how she feels about Ethan, what their relationship is, that she is actively going against her mission because, you know, he was in danger or like his life was like on the line. You know, and I think that's really like another key piece of what makes the action really good is like it's not just the excitement of like, look at this cool stuff that we figured out how to do, but it also always makes sense for the characters. And like the end of that motorcycle chase is another great example because, you know, the whole and another great example of like a little twist that the movie does where, you know, it goes through the whole thing. He gets hit. He rolls off. He pulls out a knife. Tom Cruise and starts running, and the, like you can see cops coming from like every single direction. And you're like, oh my god, like he finally messed up. Like he's run out of room to go. Like is he just going to like stab 1,000 cops to try to get away? Like what is his plan? And he jumps in between these bushes, and then the camera pans up, and you can see that like there's actually a like net over this like grate that leads down to the river, and he's actually like it looks like he's just jumped behind some bushes, but he's actually jumped into the river below where. Luther and Benji are waiting in a boat, and it was all part of the plan. And so I love that aspect of like, oh, he had this plan the whole time. But we don't know that when we're watching it. And so it's like, it's really amping up the tension of that scene because we don't know that he has a plan. We think he's just trying to get away however he can. But this whole thing was like orchestrated to have a certain outcome. And I think, again, that tells us so much about Tom Cruise's character is that he had, you know, a plan A, a plan B, a plan C, and like whatever the situation is, he has a way to react to it. And I think that that comes out through all of these action scenes.
Yeah. And I feel like for that scene in particular, there's a point where he's talking to Benji and Luther through comms, and he's like, meet me at the rendezvous point. And there's so like, it's just a little thing that happens, and there's so much action that happens between that moment and the moment where he takes out the knife that I don't know about you. I had almost forgotten about that one little point, and then he jumps in there, and then you just kind of see him on the boat with them, and you're like, what great filmmaking, like what great storytelling.
Exactly. And it is absolutely great storytelling to the point where the time that I saw it in IMAX, the audience applauded when that happened, which I feel like, you know, it's pretty rare when people applaud in the middle of a movie. you know? And it's just, I think it's so the way that this franchise is, and it's a classic sort of misdirection, you know, like the way a magician would, you know, it's like, oh, like, look at this, but really what you're actually is going on is like behind him or something. And so, you know, it really is that sort of storytelling sleight of hand that you forget in that moment. And it's the same way when they introduce Elsa, like we talked about, where you're so concentrated on what is happening right now that you're not piecing together all the other things that you know are going on. And so when it comes back, it feels like a surprise. It feels like a reveal. And then the movie tells you, like, nope, if you were paying attention, you would have figured it out. And not in a way that's like trying to make you feel bad, but just in a way of like, it's just that good. And you feel that sense of like relief from that tension where you're just like, oh my God, that was amazing. I need to applaud.
Absolutely. Absolutely couldn't have said it more. And so when you're doing podcasting, there is a level of vulnerability and bias that you bring to your show. And when it comes to comic books, I have been notoriously heavy on DC. We've been a DC really show. We've touched on Marvel stuff, and I just prefer the comics that DC puts out over Marvel. This is a personal preference. So anytime I get to talk about something that is bringing a little bit more depth to something I'm already passionate about, I love it. So Henry Cavill is probably at this point in his career most known for playing Superman, Man of Steel, Batman versus Superman, and at the same time, he is also Batman versus Superman and Justice League post mustache gate.
Yeah, we don't have to get into that.
I mean, I'm okay if like with the fact that we got a subpar Superman arc because of how good he was in this, but Henry Cavill plays a full-on villain in this, and This was probably one of my favorite parts of this movie because it just proved to me that this is the first time that I've seen him do something outside of Superman, and it just really proved to me that he's not just this shallow actor that can only portray this simple kind of emo version of Superman. But I love the fact that he feels like a good guy up until the twist with Benji and him with the manifesto. Like, to me, that was one of the best, the antagonist twists and turns is one of the best handles of this film. And it's getting to see him in a like a pure villainous role with just these bad agendas just really made me love this film all that much more.
Yeah, his performance is really good. You know, I think he's one of those actors that sometimes I even forget is, I think he's actually British, but his American accent is actually really, really good. And what I like about it is that even from before, like even when we think he's a good guy, because he's like a CIA assassin, and it turns out that he is really John Lark and he's really part of like working with Solomon Lane and the Apostles. But even when we think he's a good guy, he's still being a dick. And I think that's also something we haven't really, like that is not something that is part of Superman's character, obviously. So, you know, his relationship with Tom Cruise at the beginning, where he is really skeptical about the IMF, you know, he keeps calling it Halloween because it's like a bunch of guys in masks running around. And I love that. I love how that's all set up in terms of like, you know, the jump sequence that we talked about earlier, like, you know, he gets struck by lightning and he loses his oxygen tank, and Tom Cruise like comes over, puts his oxygen on and saves him, and like has this really hard landing on the building. And then Henry Cavill's Walker character just sort of like softly lands, like textbook perfect, exactly the way it was. And he goes, oh, it looks like you lost your oxygen tank. And it's a hilarious moment. And Cavill completely nails that like fine line between like, you know, being a sort of friendly, skeptical rival character, and then evolving into like an out and out villain. So that by the time Tom Cruise is tracking him down on foot and he's like going up in an elevator to the top of the tape monitor and to catch a helicopter, and Tom Cruise is hanging from the bottom. It's like a, you know, the cage type elevator thing. So Tom Cruise is like hanging on the bottom, and Henry Cavill's like looking down at him, and he's saying like, you know, I can't kill you right now because I'm not supposed to kill you, but I really want to kill you. And just, you know, he still has that sense of stoicism that he brings to Superman, where he's like cool and collected. But that just, I think that's just because he's a really good foil for Ethan Hunt, because they are both people who will stop at nothing to accomplish whatever mission they need to accomplish. And in his case, it's a really horrible, you know, villainous mission that is going to have a huge negative impact on the world, but he absolutely believes in it and will do whatever it takes to get there. And I think Cavill 100% nails that performance.
Yeah, and I think the one thing that he does really well in this, like you're talking about, like you, there's that sequence between him and Angela Bassett's Erica where he's trying to implement these ideas of, oh, John Lark is really Ethan Hunt, and that storyline like really threw you for a curve, and but just more than just him being villainous, like, because you don't really know throughout the course of the film whether or not you can trust him or not. I feel like that is something that is handled really well. But like you're talking about, like when he does make that full villainous turn, you can understand, and you can kind of understand where he's coming from. And I think that one of the things that makes a good villain, like I'd already talked about, is like something that makes it personal, like what Solomon Lane does in this film. But it's also a villain that thinks he's the hero in his story. I feel like, like you're talking about, like they'll go to any means necessary. And there, that elevator scene, one of the things that I think that is done, pulled off really well, is the fact that, you know, Tom Cruise has kryptonite, and this film that we haven't even really began to like talk about it is Tom Cruise has this psychological aspect of him with Julia coming back into the course of this film and beautifully handled arc. But he has this, you know, that someone's going to find him, and it's specifically Solomon Lane is going to find her and kill her and just bring death upon her. And there's that scene where he just doesn't really say anything. You just look at his face, and he just pulls out this picture of Julia, and he's like, look, if you do anything, she's gonna die. And it's so well handled. And you, at that moment, you're just like, man, Supes went there.
Yeah, and I think I think this movie really, I feel like the franchise didn't, after Julia was introduced in Mission Impossible 3, I feel like they weren't sure exactly what to do with her, because they're like, well, we can't just have her, you know, be like a damsel in distress or a weakness for Ethan Hunt in every movie, because that would get boring. And so when they did Ghost Protocol, they just have her sort of cameo at the end. So you know that she's out there. She's like, she's okay. And then she's not really even mentioned, I don't think, in Rogue Nation. And then in this movie, they really bring her back and they really complete that arc. And, you know, there's a scene that after, Henry Cavill shows her a picture and he's like, oh, if I see you again, like she's dead. And it's between Ving Rhames, Luther, and Rebecca Ferguson's character, Ilsa. And, you know, what starts off this whole mission is that Ethan Hunt chose to save Luther's life versus saving this plutonium that, Walker wants to build nuclear weapons with. And so, you know, he's talking to her and saying, like, he made this choice once. I know he would do it again. Like, don't put Ethan Hunt in a situation where he has to choose between you and saving the world, because what makes Ethan Hunt Ethan Hunt is that he values the one life as much as the millions of lives. And that's what separates him from, you know, the way the CIA is portrayed in this movie. That's what makes it Mission Impossible, is that saving everybody and not just like, yeah, we had to make some sacrifices. Like, you know, I lost my whole team, but we accomplished the mission. For Ethan, that's not mission accomplished. Mission accomplished is everybody gets out. And so that scene between the two of them where Luther actually finally explains what happened between Ethan and Julia after Mission Impossible 3. We get a little bit of it in 4, but where, you know, it's real that like her death was sort of faked so that she could like, you know, go on living. But Luther explains that like, you know, Ethan is someone who whenever he was home with Julia would be like, something bad is going to happen and I'm going to feel responsible because I wasn't out there to stop it. And she also comes to see it that way where, you know, if you're here, then who's out there? And they both have this sort of recognition that like, there is no one that can do what Ethan Hunt does. Like one of my favorite lines in Rogue Nation is when Alec Baldwin is like, he is the manifestation of destiny. And like, there's nothing that's going to get between him and accomplishing his mission. And so like that scene actually like made me really emotional because I can, you know, as someone who puts a lot of stress and anxiety on themselves, just by the way that my brain tends to work, I can only imagine if I actually felt responsible for having to stop nuclear weapons, how I would feel. And so, again, I think it all comes back to character. You know, every single great part of this movie is tied to character somehow.
Yeah. And I was writing up like my Letterboxd review for this film last night, and I was surprised that this film, one thing that this film does extremely well is there are those little moments like you're talking about, like kind of between Luther and Ilsa, that make you just kind of tear up, or the Ethan's like PTSD over Julia and Solomon Lane. I feel like those are elements that this film does extremely well, and it shows that this isn't just another action film, but this is an action film here that has depth and heart, and again just has a very grounded thing that, you know, very few action films do is that they will show that there are repercussions for the choices that you make. And I love that, you know, that's kind of the whole course of this film is like, you know, Solomon Lane talked about in the trailer with Ethan Hunt is, you know, the fallout of all your good intentions. And that's essentially the course of this film is that he made a choice at the beginning of this film and it develops and he's kind of retconning it throughout the course of this film up until the end. And I love that fact that it just brings another depth of raw, real, honest groundedness that just I think we haven't seen on the big screen probably since I would say the Dark Knight trilogy.
Yeah, I actually think the Dark Knight is a really good comparison because I recently watched it for the first time in a while. Because the 10-year anniversary was a couple weeks ago. And in watching that, like it acts in a similar way. I think, you know, those films are about different things. Like they have different themes and everything. But I think the way that, you know, all the action scenes in The Dark Knight are about the character choices and the whole movie is really about the consequences of that. I think it's really similar to Fallout. Like I think that's a really favorable comparison.
And so I think one thing that, you know, obviously we've talked about Henry Cavill, but this is the first film that brings back a villain, like we had said previously. And Solomon Lane, like, he just makes it personal. And so, like, we don't have to spend a whole lot of time on him, but there's one great scene in particular where Ethan is climbing up the rope to stop Walker. And there's just this kind of, like, smirk that he has on his face as he's watching this unfold. And, you know, Ethan, he's just at peace that it's no longer about trying to bring the system down for him. It's a little bit deeper than that. Now he wants to stop Ethan at any cost, and he's willing to die for that. And there's that scene between Lane and Walker where Walker is trying to convince him to come on the plane. He's like, nope. He's like, this is where my journey ends. It almost kind of feels like that Batman Joker element to it, and I really appreciate that because it really proves that he's after to see the world burn. Like he's just an unpredictable villain, and I feel like that's what makes him really good. And like, so Lane and Walker really play well off each other, and like this super group of like the apostles really brings a cool element to it.
I have no idea what's happening right now. I'm sorry. Oh, that's not. Good. Yeah, that's not my dog. It's somebody walking by our house, and apparently their dog is going berserk.
But there's a.
But yeah, I mean, I think. So in Rogue Nation, I thought Solomon Lane was a really good villain, and then I think in Fallout, he becomes a great villain. And I think that part of that is that relationship that you mentioned between him and Walker, and that they have different ideologies. They have a different purpose. And in this film, Solomon Lane's purpose is to, you know, blame Ethan Hunt. And it's not about, you know, it's like the simple thing of like, if he just wanted to kill Ethan, that would be really easy to do basically for him. But what he wants to do is take away everything that he cares about. He wants to take away, you know, his now ex-wife. He wants to take away his team. He wants to take away the IMF. He wants to, like, basically he wants Ethan to end up in prison to watch the world burn. So it's not just about making the world burn, but it's also making the world burn in front of this person that defeated him.
It's a great, great villain right there. All right, so we're moving on to the show, the point of our show where we call Here Roads to Hope. And this is the point of our show where we engage with our guest of the week about content and pull out a theme of hope or of mental health. And this week, for this episode in particular, we are talking about, we've already talked about it, but there's a scene in the beginning of the film where Luther has a gun to his head and Ethan chooses, you know, not to kill this guy that has Ethan or Luther at gunpoint. And there's another scene in the movie where he's kind of talking about how to Ethan the one is just as important as the million. And I feel like that is a very crucial message that we have to instill, especially to someone that is struggling with depression or self-worthlessness or self-harm or addiction or suicide, is that those things tend to, like Ryan was previously talking about how like anxiety warps your brain. Those things have a tendency to distribute lies into and think that, you know, you're not worth it. And I'm here today to tell you that you are, from someone that has gone through depression, from someone that has thought about suicide and self-harm and has gone through addiction and has gone through anxiety, is that your life, the one life, is just as valuable as the millions of lives. And you have a place in this world.
Yeah, and I think another moment in Mission Impossible Fallout that I also think captures that theme really well is when they're bringing Solomon Lane out to the car and they open the garage door and there's a Paris like cop that she just happens to be walking by, you know, and obviously putting a person who is like in a straitjacket and a hood into the back of a car looks really suspicious. So she stops to see what's going on, and she pulls out a gun, and Tom Cruise is immediately getting not only between the gun and his team, but just out in front of her and saying, like, you know, please don't do this. Like, please just walk away. Like, I can't, you know, like, basically, like, I can't explain why, but you just need to go. And, you know, we even see a shot of, you know, this is before we really know how much of a villain he is. We see a shot of Henry Cavill, like, pulling his weapon out because, you know, someone who comes from that world where he is, like, a CIA assassin would not hesitate to kill this innocent police officer who just happens to be walking by at the wrong moment, because it's getting in between him and accomplishing his mission. But for Ethan Hunt, he does everything that he can to save her life, even if it means they get slowed down, even if it means like the cops know where they are, like all that stuff. Her life is more important than that, and he will find another way to accomplish his mission. And so I think that, you know, that concept of the value of a single person's life, and that every person is, you know, unique and has value because they are alive and they are a person, I think is something that like this movie actually really, really captures throughout the entire thing.
I couldn't agree more. So just know that you have value and you have worth, and despite what anyone else is telling you or is bullies or are pouring into you or someone's pouring into your inbox, just know that you have value and you have worth, and that's a truth, that you are just as valuable as a single as the millions of people around the world are. And so with that, we are going to jump into our, again, just if you or someone you know is struggling, go to victimsandvillains.net/hope and get the resources. Start the conversation to say, hey, I feel this way, and just to know your worth and your value. So with that, we're going to jump into our top five post fallout. I'm going to let you go first, bro.
Sure. So, you know, sadly, Mission Impossible 2 drops off the top five list at this point. So then coming back up from the bottom, it's Mission Impossible 3, the original Mission Impossible, then Rogue Nation. And I'm going to put Fallout right at number two, but it's like it's by a hair. Like, you know, I think Ghost Protocol, Fallout, and Rogue Nation are all like five-star movies for me. So, like, you know, I put Ghost Protocol right just a hair over the line, but as number one. But I could sit down and watch any of these movies at any point and have just as good of a time watching it.
That's fair. And I'm gonna go the same way. The Fallout of Fallouts is gonna bump out Mission Impossible 2 and take 1 through 4 and make them 2 through 5, because Fallout is my favorite film of this franchise now. It's just there's so much to love about this. Great character development, grounded action sequences, and action sequences that do very few do, and it feels so real, so authentic, and the twists and the turns, like there's just so much about this film that I feel like you can just go back and watch in multiple viewings and just experience something new every time. And to me, what makes a great film is if I can go back and experience this film and have a desire that as soon as the credits roll to say, I want to watch this again, like I did when I walked out of like The Dark Knight, or Dark Knight is like really the only one I can think of right now in this moment. But you know, just wanting to experience this again. Another one I think of from this year would be Ready Player One. So this film definitely creeped up into that category for me. I'm going to go see it again before it ends its theatrical run. Highly recommend this film if you haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, I definitely can't recommend it more. And I would say that if Fallout was my first experience seeing a Mission Impossible in the theater, it would definitely be my number one. So I can definitely, you know, I feel like that experience absolutely lends itself, because it just seeing especially these last three movies theatrically, is they're some of the best movie going experiences I've ever had. And as someone who sees a lot of movies, like that is a really high bar. You know, I mean, for me, I'd almost have to go back to the first Avengers movie to like get that high of like, all right, credits are over. Like, just let me take a walk. Let me use the bathroom, get some more popcorn. I'm coming back to my seat and let's do this again. And like, that is exactly how I felt after seeing Fallout. It's absolutely an incredible movie on like every, it's like I said before, it's everything I want from a movie for sure.
Yeah. And I cannot, again, I love this film, and it quickly jumped its way into like the top three of this year for me. Very few films have just kind of made me love their product as quickly. And mm-hmm. So a lot of films, like, I feel like I have to like sit on and say, what did I really think about this? But Fallout, you just walk out on such a high, and it's so character like driven. Like, you feel like you just got done on a roller coaster on this, because like the action sequences are so good, but there's also that element of like character, like just like character, like little small character moments mm-hmm. that make you want to like tear up just a little bit.
I feel like there's a lot of truth in the movie in terms of, you know, both the realism and the action that we've been talking about, but it's true to the characters, it's true to the emotions, you know what I mean, in each moment. And for me, like, one of the hallmarks of a really great movie is that the more you talk about it, the more you love it, because like that's that sitting with period. Like, sometimes the more you think about a movie, you're like, well, okay, like I can see why it's really exciting in the moment, but like now that I go back and think about it, like this doesn't really, like, you know, not like plot holes or anything, but just like this doesn't quite, you know, sing the way that like a truly great movie does. And I think, you know, after this discussion that I've had about Fallout with, you know, discussions with, you know, my wife and my other friends, like, there's nothing, like, every time we talk about this movie, there's something new that I find to love. And I think that is, like, truly, like, one of the best signs that I've just seen something great.
Same. So if you guys have seen Mission Impossible Fallout, what did you guys think of it? Make sure that you guys comment below on the link to this episode or tweet to us at Victims and Villains. Write to us on Facebook at Victims and Villains. And with that social media cue means we have reached our end. So this podcast will self-destruct in just a few minutes. But before we self-destruct, where can people find your content online?
Sure. You can find me writing about movies on cinadelphia.com. You can also find my podcast, The Shame Files, wherever you listen to podcasts. So whatever app you use, be it Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or whatever, if you search Shame Files, will come up. And then you can also find me on social media, on Twitter and Letterboxd and Instagram at Silber whatever. That's with a B. Yeah. So that's me.
And you guys can find us everywhere, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, and iTunes. Make sure that you guys like, follow, and subscribe to us. And if you guys like what we stand for, make sure that you guys support us on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/victimsandvillains. Consider being a part of our Facebook group, Hope Culture, and sign up for our monthly newsletter. Not to mention, again, you guys can go to victimsandvillains.net/hope for resources if you guys are struggling with suicide, addiction, self-harm, or depression. And until next time, remember to keep talking, nerd, talking hope, and speaking nothing else.